Hello everyone, and welcome to today's Prevention Connection web conference. I now like to turn the call over to Mr. David Lee. Mr. Lee, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and welcome everyone to the Prevention Connection web conference. How do we measure the prevention of violence against women? I know that a lot of you were waiting on the phone for a while to get in, and this is a very large session. In fact, this looks like it will be the largest session that we've ever had at Prevention Connection, and so we will be hoping that you'll get in there soon, getting in soon. So I'd like to welcome you to our web conference, and I will be able to, we're going to do something a little new, and then you can be able to see me live. So this is what I look like as I am talking in my office. This is our Prevention Connection team, and if you want to contact Prevention Connection about other work, please feel free to call, to send an email to myself or Chad or other members of our team who are working with us. Chad and I do most of the content work with Prevention Connection. On the next slide, I just want to highlight what's on our, available on our website at www.preventconnect.org. And on our website, you can find podcasts, online presentations that are short, summaries of our web conferences, and also our Prevention Connection Wiki. And the Prevention Connection Wiki is a place where people can add information from our program to be able to add different information from our program that about building the knowledge base of prevention work throughout our throughout the country by people adding information. So thank you very much. We will be able to please enter on the Prevention Connection Wiki and look at that. Look at the collective wisdom of people within the field. And right now, Larry Lewis. You also on our website can sign up for Prevention Connection's listserv. We have about 900 people who participate in an active listserv looking at issues of violence against women, prevention, and being able to share ideas with each other. You also can sign up for our web conferences and our web dialogues, which we call the Reading Club. And this is a place where we have small gatherings that take readings on violence against women prevention and discuss them to be able to look at the applications to violence against women prevention. We also have materials and archives of our previous web conferences, and so we can be able to move forward. And someone asked if you can mute. You are all muted right now. You're just getting the speaker's phone, so you do not need to worry about mute for your phone. So thank you much. I want to let you know that our upcoming web conference that's going to be coming up is going to be up. The topic is TERP is not a four-letter word, Advancing Violence Against Women Prevention Partnerships. This will be led by the Prevention Institute. This will be held on May 14th. Registration will be open when you finish this web conference. So as you finish your evaluation and go to the PreventConnect.org page, you can register for this web conference. Web conferences do fill up quickly, so I do encourage you to register as quick upon finishing today's session. I want to talk a little bit about how to use this technology that we have here, and there's many different features that you can have in being able to understand what we're doing. The first feature that I want to talk about is the feature of raising your hand, and the way you do that is if you look on the bar above my picture, you'll see a hand here, and that's how you can raise your hand. Can everyone please raise their hand? And I see that a lot of you are raising your hand. That's great. This is the one we will might periodically be asking questions. Someone accidentally cleared it, so great. So that's one of the ways we can get information. And when we are doing a question and answer question, we will ask you to raise your hand, and that's the time we'll do that. I'm going to, so thank you very much. I'm going to lower all your hands now. So I see more people are doing that. The other feature that we have is called our questions and answers. And the questions and answers are another way that we can be able to get information about who each of you are. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to run a question right now. And this should be, and it's going to be here so we can learn about who's in the audience and it's saying, please wait while the question is being prepared. And now I will have my first question that I am going to ask you all. And this is, how many web conferences have you attended before today? One is that this is your very first web conference you've attended. Two is that you've attended one web conference before. Three would be if you've attended 2 to 3 web conferences. And 4 is 4 or more. So go ahead and vote. Oh, I am seeing that my question seems to have disappeared from the screen. No, you should be able to vote. And I'm having a little bit of technical problem here, so I'm going to actually close the question, or try to close the question. And I am finding that I, once again, technology sometimes works beautifully, and sometimes it's going to be very difficult. So I've asked the question, and I've seen that some of you have voted, so great, keep on voting, please. And I will share the answer. It took a little bit while for me to be able to share this answer. The results, and you can see that, and many of you are doing this in the text chat, because you haven't done this here, and I am trying to share the results, and you can see that, and it is not appearing like it is supposed to. So how's that for wonderful technology working the way it's supposed to? So I'm going to withdraw the question. Now it finally appeared. You can see that 30% of you have wanted this many times, and 13% of you, this is your first web conference that you have attended. So it's really great to see everyone there. I do want to get a sense of who your organizations are. So I am going to go here and withdraw that question. And now I'm going to pose the question of, can you describe what your organization is? And we have several menu options for that that should be appearing on your screen. One is if you're a domestic violence agency, it might be a prevention agency or some other type of domestic violence agency. Two would be a sexual assault type agency, a rape crisis center or a prevention agency. Three is if you're with a public health department. And number 4 is if you're education, college, university, or some type of research, which I looks like I misspelled, and 5 would be some type of other. So please write down what type of organization that you are with. And I see we are getting many people voting. And I am now going to write, many people are writing these down. On the bottom, and actually have a lot of different responses. A lot of people are dual agencies that are doing both. I'm going to share the results with you all, which should be appearing. And in the results, you can see that we have a lot of people from domestic violence organizations, over 20%, and I am waiting for that to appear. We seem to be with 223 people on. It's a little bit of a slow connection. And the results have not shared yet, so this is working quite slowly. And we will, but we have over 20% from domestic violence agencies. I see 12% from education, 9% from public health departments, and I can't see the number for sexual assault, 14% from sexual assault departments, so sexual assault prevention agencies. So I'm going to close these questions now. I'm going to close all of your tabs here, and I'm going to come back to our screen. We do have the text chat, which many of you are using. We will be using this. We also have our PowerPoint slides. Well, for the text chat, you might find it easier to read the text chat if you undock it. You undock it by this little box here that I just circled. You can be able to click that box, and that will open it up and make it easier to read the text chat. We also have copies of all of our slides on our webpage. So that's another place that you can be able to get information about what we are doing. Let me go to our next page. If you have something, you just send a text chat, and we will get back to you and answer questions. Or you can call IRIS Technical Assistance at 800-799-4510, or you can call us at CalCasa at 888-922-5227, and Chad can be able to assist you. For our conference today, we are talking about violence against women. We are looking at issues of domestic violence and sexual violence and looking at violence across the lifespan. We also want to be able to prevent before violence starts, as we are looking at primary prevention. We want to be able to connect to other forms of violence. And for Prevention Connection does have several other collaborative partners that we work with, and I see many of whom are on the line today. These are national resource centers that are funded by the Centers for Disease Control, and I encourage you to visit their websites, the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, the National Youth Violence Prevention Resource Center, and VOLNET, the National Online Resource Center on Violence Against Women. Prevention Connection is sponsored by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views and information provided in this web conference do not necessarily represent the official views of the United States government, the CDC, or the ALCASA. So with that, I'd like to begin our discussion of looking at how do we measure the prevention of violence against women. And I'm really glad to be able to have each of you on. Another thing that we will be doing today in this conversation is we will be recording this conversation, not just the audio recording, but also a graphic recording. And what you see on the screen is that we have Stephen Wright, looks like this, who will be drawing the picture of our conversation. So, Stephen, it looks like you need to close your window and reopen it again because I don't have anything since the very beginning, since the welcome. It's just appeared there. So you can see the discussion, and you will be capturing our discussion. You'll be able to see our discussion as time goes on. So I'm going to come back here and go back to our slides. What we will be first doing is I'll be offering you a brief framework about measurements of primary prevention. And then we'll have our guests come and have a discussion and talking with each other about this issue. And then we will, and it appears that Sarah Cook has needs to rejoin because your connection has closed, just so you know that, Sarah. And that we will then be opening this discussion to all of you, and then we will be doing our evaluation. And that the goals for today is actually a very difficult conversation, and many people ask, are you going to tell us exactly how to measure primary prevention? And the answer is, and I get laughs from our panelists, is that we know how difficult that is. And so what we want to do is use this discussion to really talk about this, and they're not going to present the perfect solutions that no one has developed, but be able to talk about some of the challenges in measuring prevention and identify some of the potential approaches that we think are going to be really important as we are working toward that finding ways to measure the prevention. And we'll use this technology to be able to build our connection of people who are interested in this topic. This topic was very interesting. You all signed up very quickly, and a lot of people were really interested. And it's great seeing people write in where they are from, so I see a lot of that information. Now, we're talking about prevention, and I'm going to use the definition from Prevention Institute, who does a lot of work, one of our important partners in developing our Prevention Connection web conferences, and they talk about prevention as a systematic process that promotes healthy environments and behaviors and reduces the likelihood of frequency of injury or prevention. And fundamentally, it's about taking action before violence takes place to prevent the initial perpetration or victimization. And then this is part of what we're trying to do is find a way to measure it before. So this is not just looking, and all forms of prevention are important, but we really want to focus on how we can be able to advance the primary prevention. Now, when we look at prevention measures, I went to what is this common standard, and one of them is Healthy People 2010. And right now they're actually in the process of gathering information to put together the goals for Healthy People 2020. And here's just two of the goals that are relevant to violence against women. To reduce the rate of physical assault by current or former intimate partner, or to reduce the annual rate of rape or attempted rape. And then you actually see targets that they give for numbers, and that those target numbers are based on the National Crime Victimization Survey. Yet if we want to be able to measure prevention, I believe that this is going to be a very difficult way to be able to really look at the success of our prevention efforts that we're doing in the field. That to be able to make these changes, there's challenges with the survey, the National Crime Victimization Survey itself and what it identifies, and that the work we're doing is long-term social change work that takes much more than being able to expect in a short time that we can be able to lead to these reductions. In fact, often our work looks like we are going to make increases because more people might be reporting the abuse that they're experiencing. Another challenge that we have is how do we measure the absence of something? Because our work is to prevent rape and to prevent domestic violence. And so how do we measure the absence of these? And what does that look like? And how do we look at from an asset perspective or a protective factor asset? Factors of understanding the work we're doing. And then this becomes one of those how do you measure a void, which I think is very difficult, which often makes me curious to see. Stephen is going to be trying to write down how we will do this. So, Stephen, I see your screen, but I have not seen your more recent pictures. So you might need to reload that. So I'm going to hand the podium over to you. Able to do that, but I'm not able to hand the podium over. Stephen. Oh, there's Mina has the podium. Can you hand it over to, can one of the other speakers please hand the podium to Stephen? I don't Mina right now.
Hey, how do I do that?
Oops, I just got disconnected. So see, this technology works for everyone, and sometimes we get disconnected, and I am rejoining my session right here.
Thank you.
I have now gotten back on, and we will be on slide 15. I'm now going to move to slide 16. So what do we measure? And that's one of the questions that we need to be able to look at. Are we going to try to measure the protective factors? And how do we find ways to look at those factors as opposed to only looking at the risks associated, but find ways to be able to move forward with some of our protective factors, which I think is really one of the promising ways that we can be able to move forward. Similarly, we need to look at resiliency. And there's quite a bit of resiliency research, not associated specifically with violence against women, but around factors that are probably related to violence against women to preventing initial perpetration and victimization. We want to be able to look at that. We also are looking a lot at not just individual factors, but how do we look at community factors and look at issues such as that we'll talk about today, social capital, or how to be able to change the community climate. Because indeed, we know the changes we want to do are not just about changing individuals, but being able to change communities. And then how do we measure these positive factors, whether it is going to be framed as healthy relationships or healthy sexuality, and there's questions about that, but we need to think about how do we measure these different types of factors. I do want to remind us, of course, of the socio-ecological models. I think it's really important. A lot of our evaluation work has been done around individual knowledges and attitudes and perhaps behaviors, and we have not been able to find ways to really look at relationships, community, or even create the measurement of society. And that's where we want to be able to look at is creating those types of measures on all the levels and make sure that our interventions are not just individual interventions, but also looking, operating at other levels of the social ecology. So I really want to stress that we need to look at the community as a unit of analysis, because a lot of our work has been working doing individuals, one at a time, measuring them, doing our pre and post tests, and then how do we be able to find a way to measure the community as a whole? And I'm trying to draw a picture of the community as a whole with my stick figures here. Another piece that's important is looking at evidence-based practices, and that many of all of us are very interested in being able to find ways to use the evidence that exists to be able to identify how we're going to be able to move forward. This is from an article that just appeared this month, April 2008, the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. And it talked about injury prevention interventions. And it talked about that before we disseminate interventions, we need to be able to evaluate it, and they really recommend that we need to do this on the population level. In this, they talked about what are the designs and what the evidence should be, and they talked about strategies such as randomized controlled trials, non-randomized controlled trials, observational studies, including cohorts, case control, and ecologic designs.
When we think about violence against women prevention, though, we have to be aware that we are in a field that is still in its early stages. Now, the work that we've been doing in violence against women prevention has been started from the grassroots efforts, often not starting with academics or from major institutions, and at those early stages, take a while before we're going to be able to find the evidence. Some people describe a lag of 15 years from when you do your initial efforts before you're going to see information that are going to be undergo rigorous evaluation and those that will eventually be done in research and published in peer-reviewed journals. On the Prevent Connect listserv, we actually post abstracts of all the, in the peer-reviewed journals, articles that are related to violence against women, though very few of them look at the prevention effort itself. They all more talk about the dynamics of violence against women and then talk about implications for prevention. Very little research has been done on prevention. We know that there's many efforts on the local community and there's many promising practices. And indeed, the work that the people in this audience have been doing that are here, we know is very powerful and does very important work. And so we need to find ways to also measure not just the final outcomes, but also to measure what I term the evidence of practice. How do we take the evidence of the work that we're doing, find ways to look at it, and use our measurements and research and evaluation process to improve what we do, understand what we do, and be able to look at how we can both move forward to changes. And so we need to be able to engage in the discussion of what I call the evidence-building process, of being able to move forward, to be able to talk about how we can build the evidence to move forward. I saw recently, and Prevention Connection is talking about trying to collaborate with efforts to be able to collect examples of what are the different promising practices out in the field and be able to ask people right about their experiences in doing that work and the lessons learned that then can inform the future research of what they will be doing. So these are some of the questions and the pieces that we want to think about. And what we've done is brought together a panel of people who have been looking at the research and evaluation in violence against women field and different violence prevention fields to be able to have them be able to share some of their thoughts on the work they've done. And so today is going to be primarily the discussion from these people about the work that they have done. So I'm going to introduce our panel that we have here, and I'm going to start with Patricia Kelly. Will be the, and Patricia is a professor at the School of Nursing at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Hello, Pat.
Hi, hi, Paul. Hi, everyone.
Hi, and I met Pat at the American Public Health Association as we were having a discussion. We were looking about community factors, and it was a really great discussion to be able to have that. So Pat will be sharing a little bit shortly. We also have Myna White, who is, and hello, Myna.
Hi.
And Myna is right down a few blocks away from me, over with the California Department of Public Health, the Epidemiology and Prevention and Injury Control Branch. And she has worked doing some of the evaluation of California's MyStrength campaign that she will be talking about a little bit later. So welcome, Myna. We also have Paul Shuey. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
And Paul is the director of the Interdisciplinary Center for Research on Violence at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Many of us have read Paul's work, talking about his research on evaluation and his work with community-based organizations to be able to, especially around the agencies and rape crisis centers, to be able to really develop effective prevention work. So Paul will be sharing a little bit about some of his insights into that work. And we also have Sarah Cook. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, everyone.
And Sarah is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Georgia State University and does work, currently is doing some work with the Centers for Disease Control on their rape prevention education program, beginning to look at what are some indicators and measurements that she'll be able to talk about. So this is our panel that we will be doing. As I said, we are going to have this conversation and share the screen. And Stephen, looks like I'm going to close your window. I'm going to close the tab. Oh, it just appeared. So it's not. I'm going to close this. And Stephen, can you reshare your?
Is it David?
Yes. and I am seeing a, you should, you, I see you are all seeing a start menu, and I'm going to try to get back to the screen, and I think I inadvertently know what I did, so it looks like we are having a little bit, once again, there's been challenges with our piece, so Stephen's going to be trying to do that, and no one is seeing a, you're seeing a island screen and not seeing, Stephen's going to be sharing his screen with us shortly.
There?
If people see your name changing color, that just has to do with your next connection speed. So I am going to close, Maya clicked on her name, but I'm going to try to get this back to Stephen so he can open up his window. I apologize for this. I am going to close. I think I need to close everyone's tab, and I'm going to open up the presentation again. And you should be getting the presentation shortly. So, Stephen, are you able to share your screen? I see people see Stephen's picture, and we are waiting for a screen here, so I apologize.
Yes.
Okay, well, we will, great, so now we are getting to our... And Stephen, I don't see your screen yet.
I may have to reconnect here.
You have to reconnect. One of the lessons we are learning, we're trying to see new things with our technology, and with so many people, some people are seeing the title slide, and the title slide should be changing, and I am just moving to that screen. Well, why don't we start our conversation as we do this technology, and let's talk about what are some of the challenges in doing prevention, and there we've got a screen which is a little bit ahead of where we're going. On slide 23, I'm going to try to go back to, I think it's slide 20. So that should be happening shortly. So let's start with some of our challenges. What are some of the challenges in doing prevention? Who wants to start?
I'll start.
Okay, and say who you are.
I'm Pat Kelly.
Hi, Pat.
And I think that one of the challenges is that we are often, for primary prevention, we're working with healthy populations. And these populations probably have a fairly high threshold on any of the standard instruments that we use, of the attitudes or behavior instruments. They're in very, they're often in good shape. And so we don't, doing simple pre and post doesn't give a lot of room for movement. So we are kind of stymied. It looks like we haven't had any impact at all.
This is Maya. I also wanted to add that too, because and what Pat said was a good point, and especially when you think of the most pre and post tests, they are maybe 6 months apart, or you know, maybe a year apart, and it's so hard to measure change in that short of a time period as well.
Right, and I'll just continue with that, because the effect that we want to see may not be necessary for years. I mean, for primary prevention, violence against women, if we're working with middle school students, which is really where we want to do primary prevention, we may not see positive attitudes demonstrated for 4, 5, 6 years. And most of our studies don't go on that long.
And this is Paul. And then an associated problem with that is that even if we do follow those middle school students, and Patty, you alluded to this earlier, if we follow them 6 or 7 or 8 years, we would have to intervene with thousands and thousands and thousands of young people to find a difference in the rate of sexual offending between a treatment and a no treatment control group, just because so few sexual assaults ever come to the attention of public record, you know, through convictions. And so clearly the thing that we've done instead is to try and look at some intermediate sexual assault. We're trying to look at, you know, what are some of the changes in knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors that, you know, logically, if these things change, we may see a reduction in sexual assault later. And of course, as we all know, the link between knowledge and attitude and actual behavior is pretty weak. So that's been a real challenge to the field.
This is Sarah, and I would just add on top of what Thomas said is that conditions at an individual level, behaviors, beliefs, attitudes, etc., we have to look at the way we can change our communities to encourage that individual level change. And to date, a lot of our kind of one-time interventions simply aren't going to have the kind of impact that is going to lead to immediate change that we can detect, or even a change, you know, 6 or 7 years later. So in addition to the individual level, one challenge is looking at factors beyond the individual and that those has, I really like what David has termed the evidence of practice.
Someone has got a computer, I hear your computer loudly, one of our speakers, so if you can move your phone or move a little farther away, that'd be great. Sorry, Pat, Sarah, I was interrupting.
No, I was just giving you a compliment, David, that I like the evidence of practice, that these larger levels of individual, what we really need to document in terms of prevention are whether our communities are doing the kinds of things that theoretically support the individual change in attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors.
Now, I find it often that when we think about the prevention that it's hard because we, you know, in measuring this, that we talk about the time frame about what we want to be able to capture and to be able to find ways that to make the information be really useful, and that we need to sometimes look at the process, that I think our process evaluation is really important for what we do because that's going to help inform how we build forward, and that sometimes we don't want to lose sight of the outcomes, but we have to be really attentive to our processes. Other comments?
Or, I'm just going to add that, or have other kinds of outcomes.
What type of other outcomes do you think of, Pat?
Do you want to go out of order?
I'm supposed to go in order. Well, why don't we start with Sarah to talk a little bit about what we talk about, we use the term measures, and I had a lot of fun putting graphics, and now finally you've gotten your slides back. We're trying to work some of our technology here behind the scenes. Sarah, can you talk about some of the differences between indicators and measures? And for all the presenters, can one of you opened up the floor holder tab, and if you can close that tab, that would be really great because only you can do that, and I do not have the power. Well, one of you did that, so everyone can see the picture. So one of you go look on the floor holder tab and see if you have a little X and close that little red X, and you can close that. So it's one of our speakers who did that. Otherwise, Sarah, why don't you talk about the work that you've been doing with the Centers for Disease Control around indicators and measures.
Sure. We're working with the CDC on the Rape Prevention Education Program to identify a measurement and indicator model for all the sorts of activities that are funded through the Rape Prevention Education Program. And what we have found helpful so far is to talk about measures that exist and indicators that exist. And the difference really is, as we've been operationalizing this, is that measures are often a more direct measure, assessment of perhaps an attitude or even a process. And an indicator may not be a direct measure, but may do precisely that. It may indicate some process, or it may indicate some change, but it may not be a direct assessment. And both of these can be used to look at process and outcomes and prevention. And as Paul pointed out in a previous conversation, one isn't necessarily better than the other. Sometimes an indicator might be a more valid measurement and a more practical one, because obtaining some kind of direct measure might be really difficult. For example, in the rape prevention education program, one of the first steps in the theory model is community readiness. Well, how do you go about assessing community readiness? One of the steps is seen as their community awareness of sexual assault as a problem. Well, you could, I guess, directly go ask folks in a community about whether they think there's a problem, or perhaps you could get an indicator of how aware folks are in a particular community, perhaps by the number of groups in the community that are meeting about a particular problem, or have put forth that issue on an agenda, maybe gone to the County Board of Commissioners and requested funding or time on an agenda. So that might give a brief example of the difference between indicators and measures, and that's also something that a lot of you who are RPD recipients will be seeing in the future.
So, is there one better than other indicators?
Well, I guess my bias, that Paul kind of corrected some of that, I think, thank you, Paul, last week, is that as a psychologist, I tend to prefer direct measures, but I think he made a really good point that sometimes indicators are a very valid, albeit indirect, way to assess what may be going on in a community. Furthermore, they may be far more practical than using some kind of established, published measurement instrument that might be more labor-intensive and much more difficult to administer. So I don't think one is better than the other, but I think we need to make room for both.
Yeah, I know. Pat, you would talk about some of the challenges of using some of these measurement tools in a community-based setting.
Right. I think especially with high-risk populations, I worked with girls in the juvenile justice system, and they really had minimal comprehension of anything that was conceptual. Words like syphilis or gonorrhea, which came from a standardized pregnancy prevention survey, they didn't understand, and they also had zero tolerance for repeat questions. You asked us this already. Why are you asking this again? Even though they were reverse worded. And there was a limit. Probably 30 to 40 questions was as many as we could coax them to complete.
And so I think this is an interesting question as we begin to think about how do we do work. And so in some ways I hadn't thought about it when we came up with the title of this. We said, how is that measurement? But it's not just measurement, but it's also how do we find indicators or ways that indicators can be really useful in what we do. Paul, did you want to add something about developing indicators?
Well, just that, I mean, I think the one example we talked about from last week, is pretty important. So let's say we're doing a sexual assault or a teen dating violence prevention program in a middle school. One of the differences we might want to see with kids after we teach them about respect and healthy relationships, et cetera, is that there might be fewer disciplinary referrals to the assistant principal's office. And so that's a indicator, rather than a measure of the changes in beliefs and behaviors. But certainly from a school standpoint, they're going to be much more interested if we can say that we can reduce disciplinary referrals than if we can say, we can change, kids' behavioral intentions on a 10-point scale.
Well, now everyone is seeing on the screen a drawing of the part of our conversation, and what happens is that Stephen shared an entire screen, so we are now seeing what appears on his computer as opposed to the section that we had talked about. So if you can close that down and do it again, Stephen, that would be really helpful. Because you have control and we do not. There. And I'm going to close the power board on here. So this is just one of our technology. It's great
when it works. Thank you, Paul. I'm going to move to our next speech. Sarah, can you talk about the RPE model of community change and how this might inform thinking about what type of measurements or indicators we might try to look depending on what we're trying to do?
Sure. This is a distilled version of the RPE model of creating safer communities. And I appreciate, David, the time it took to try to distill this. But this essentially shows what could happen theoretically if we make changes all the way from a community level, if you follow the arrows, all the way through to individuals to actually see a reduction in sexual violence. So there may be activities, interventions at each one of these levels. And when I say level, I'm referring to each one of the boxes. There are things that we can do at the community level to get the community ready, to have them be aware of the problem. And next step may be that communities recognize there's a need for leadership for prevention. Then they may recognize that they need to have a plan, and so they come together and mobilize groups to develop a plan, and that produces a collective vision about the prevention of sexual violence. So all of these steps along community readiness could then make community and state level initiatives the next logical step in a sense. So there may be a number of things under that community and state level initiative. There might be some public policy changes that come around. It could start promoting changes in social norms and social messages about healthy relationships, et cetera. So the plan I'm trying to make is that within each of these boxes, there are a large number of activities and steps that can be taken en route to prevention. And then the challenge is trying to figure out how to document or assess each of these steps for all these activities, both in terms of the process, what went on, as well as the outcomes, and what was the end goal, and did we achieve it through each of these steps. So I think this model shows a wonderful way of laying out what you might measure in terms of the evidence. What do you term the evidence of practice?
Evidence of practice. So let me, just so everyone knows, right, someone did pose a question about RPE is a program from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which provides funding to each state and territory around primary prevention, to advance primary prevention of sexual assault. And in this, they're trying to be able to provide tools, and the work that Sarah's been doing is trying to support them, those grantees, to be able to have tools to measure what they're doing. It looks like you do different things than what you're trying to do. So if you're trying to determine if your community's ready, you're going to measure something very different than if you're trying to measure how individuals are changing their beliefs and behaviors. And that the suggestion in this is that you should start with that you need your community ready and then develop some different statewide, try to saturate communities and states with these initiatives, will then lead to some initial changes, et cetera, through the line. And this is distilled from a larger chart that is posted on preventconnect.org. And if you look under, you'll see this under Sarah Cook, and you'll have a very large diagram that you couldn't read on the screen. So what's an example of a community readiness for anyone here? What's an example of a community readiness type of measure that we might look at?
Well, there actually are a host of community readiness measures, including one developed by the Tri-Ethnic Center. And the emphasis of the different measures differs across the measures. They all look at slightly different things. They tend to be pretty time-intensive measures, though, consisting of in-depth interviews with key stakeholders and communities. So an organization might want to look at a number of these community readiness measures and might want to pick from different ones which segments you know, fit the best for their community, and which ones are going to be feasible with the time and the human resources and financial resources that an organization has.
Might be using key informant interviews to be able to find ways to gather information about people that are willing to take on the prevention, to
exactly.
address prevention. Now, there's several really good questions. One was, is this a logic model, which Stephanie Thompson answered. Yes, this is only one part of much larger detail. So would you describe this as a logic model, Sarah?
I'm glad that Stephanie's on board because she and Becky Campbell actually developed this model with the CDC and the National Alliance for Rape Elimination and also the State Department of Health. And we call it a theory model. Yes, I do think that it is a logic model as well. It tells us logically how intervention at one step or at one level, at the community level, leads to changes, a next set of changes at another level. You know, down the way, all these things will lead to individual change. So it'll create a context or a community that will can promote individual change.
What I like about this is that it really does look at the interaction from a community level force with the individual. It doesn't jump straight to trying to, how do we change individuals, which I think often is where we've been stuck. I want to move on to, just because I'm aware of our time, to be able to talk to Paul a little bit about the work he's done with the ICASA project. So, Paul, can you talk a little bit about what the ICASA project is, that's the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault?
Sure. So, several years ago, back in 99, the leaders of, Clyde Thompson and Cheryl Corbin of the Illinois Sexual Assault Coalition, came to me and said, and they talked about wanting to kind of improve their sexual assault prevention program. And that little conversation has embarked us on a 9-year project, to try and we've implemented a series of evaluation projects. So the first thing we wanted to do, or one of the things we needed, was some way to measure the effectiveness of the agency's rape prevention efforts. So the first thing we did was we surveyed all the prevention educators. There's about 30 community crisis centers in the state at that time, and we surveyed them just to learn about their existing practices. And so we learned that they were doing interventions basically kindergarten through college, and they were doing, all sorts of interventions in between. We learned a little bit about the content and the format of their interventions. And then the next thing we did is we basically asked them the question, and then we decided to focus on high school students because pretty much every agency addressed high school students and their prevention education. And so we asked them, how do you expect your students to be different, after participating in the prevention program? And so we did a lot of, just brainstorming around that question, and the responses that the educators came up with were really interesting. Two other things that we did that I'm just going to mention kind of briefly is we used logic models. So the prevention educators kind of described their intervention. They described the immediate impact that they thought their intervention would have on their students. And we tried to distill some measurable objectives from those immediate impacts. And then ultimately for all of the programs, their goals were to reduce sexual assault and to increase the number of survivors that sought help from rape crisis centers. And then we also gave the prevention educators copies of existing evaluation measures to kind of help them as they develop their own and to kind of assist with brainstorming.
And on preventconnect.org, there are several, Paul has provided several of those evaluations, sometimes those measuring people around for men and women, and also intimidating violence evaluation tools or antigen tools. Can you talk about those a little bit?
And so, one result of that project is that kind of for the first time, we very quickly realized that the goals of the prevention programs for our male students was very different than the goals of our program for the female students. So we came up with different evaluation tools for males and females. And as you said, David, those are posted on your website. People can feel free to download those and use those. Those were very useful. They were made specifically, for the Illinois program. But after a survey in prevention programs nationwide, those Illinois programs are doing pretty similar work to what prevention educators are doing across the country.
Hey, let's do a little bit of brainstorming as a group here, and that's some of the process that you did, Paul, with the centers in Illinois, is to brainstorm what are some potential indicators that people might be doing, and then you broke it in several categories. Now that I finally got to see this picture up there, I'm wary too, but I will jump back to here. You said we started with the usual suspects, knowledge and attitude. So people can I see someone has someone just emailed us said that they've got a fire drill, so she has to leave. But all exciting things happen. Can you go into the text chat, everyone, and write about what are some of the outcomes or objectives that you would want to do of changes you'd like to see on knowledge and attitudes that are related to violence against women prevention? So, and we do have the actual surveys themselves are on the web conference. So why don't you go ahead and write what are some of the increased, what type of outcomes or objectives that you would like to see? And I see someone and type this in the text chat. So one was increased awareness of the role of bystanders, rape supportive attitudes. Pat talked about self-efficacy. Can someone just describe what self-efficacy is? Pat, can you just describe what that is? Briefly, I think you might have mute on.
The sense that you can do something, that you actually are capable of putting on a condom or asking someone to put on a condom or saying, hey, that's the wrong thing to do, that's harassment.
Right, so to actually, so self-efficacy to take that I feel confident that I can do a bystander role in preventing sexual assault.
Right.
So some of our ability to ask and listen to a sexual partner, intervene in sexist language. About higher media literacy, and some of that media literacy might get to our skill building pieces that we'll talk about in a minute. More communication to young women to limit sexual activity at a young age. Increasing healthy relationships, and that one we might want to think about what are the knowledge and attitudes that go behind what a healthy relationship would be. And that more specific, that would be really helpful. Self-efficacy and negotiation with the partner. Challenging traditional gender roles or having less rigid gender norms. Dispel myths, and some of this is about knowledge and attitudes, but dispelling myths, whether it be this person wrote only about women are abused, but there's other myths. For perpetration reduction, we should probably think about what are the knowledge and attitudes that we associate with perpetration reduction. So understand depression and looking at the relationship of prevention. We might want to look at awareness and attitudes about pornography, looking at the relationship, or challenging sexual toxicity. Increase men's ability to speak to each other men about negative attitudes about women. Know that young men can also be victims. We will be posting this list on our listserv at the end of the session. So is there some, Paul, or any other usual suspects that you would want to make sure that we should mention?
Wow, they certainly hit a lot of them. Some other knowledge and attitude things might include like the warning signs of an abusive person, alcohol and gateway drugs. Some of the chat went by so fast, I'm sure a lot of these were mentioned, and I may have missed them. Perhaps some discussion of the negative consequences of that raising holes for both men and women. But I'm impressed with what I saw buzzing through my chat screen there.
people can, we will, as I said, post this on at preventconnect.org after the session so people can then look at this and get ideas. Now, beyond, now one of the challenges with attitudes and beliefs is that, and I think Patricia talked about this, Patrick mentioned earlier, that we're in a lot better shape than we were. So doing this 10 years ago, it comes out very different than today. What do you think about that, Paul?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case, where we're more and more, when you take the typical, rate-myth acceptance scale, it seems like kids nowadays, pre-intervention, before the rate prevention program, they're scoring very well on those measures. And so, yeah, there's not a whole lot of room for improvement, after the end of your program. So I think our big challenge today, one of our success stories is that, kids out there at a pretty young age kind of get it. They understand, they've heard about rape and sexual assault and consent, and they understand that at least when they get a survey about sexual assault, they kind of know how to give us the right answer.
So that's something I found that we were doing some work in California that we tried to measure. We found very little improvement around their knowledge about sexual assault because they do so much to start with, but then we were really looking at the self-efficacy and then some of the behavioral intention.
Yeah.
So let's get to skill building, because that's the next piece that you were talking about. And that skill building, let's write some ideas down about what would be some of the skill building pieces that... what are some of the objectives that you'd want to be able to do around skills, and what particular skills? I know several people talked about those skills earlier. Well, let's just get a little bit to think about not just the attitudes and beliefs, but skills. And great. So I see here, and many of you are asking questions, and we do have links to Paul's personal web page and also this project's website on the website, so you can be able to get information. So conflict resolution, bystander skills, skill building, not just on talking about skills, but getting opportunities to practice them so that it becomes a little harder to evaluate, particularly with the pre and post test, communication skills, assertiveness, standing up, speaking up, bystander skills, such as confronting race-supportive behaviors, asking for consent, increased skills for faith communities to address these issues in marriage preparation. So we might not just be looking at the skills, but then you might be looking at the policies, such as what are the guiding tools that would guide faith leaders and how they talk about issues when they're doing premarital counseling. Responder skills, self-advocacy. I hear someone's typewriter just so they... keyboard. No one uses typewriters. How to write an op-ed. I love that. That's a wonderful skill, particularly as you're developing people's leadership skills for them to be able to take a role. Self-defense, recognition of potential dangerous events. Okay, great. So those are one of the skills. Now, as you can see, we're sort of moving in the discussion as Stephen shows a little bit more of his drawing here. The next piece was about behaviors. And now if we go just to the skill, but in order to get to the skill, we need to get to a way that we can find a way to measure the behaviors. And so why don't we now write down where some of those behaviors, some of you are moving there, what are some of the behaviors we want to measure? And it's often hard to measure, have you been raped, the actual rape or domestic violence behaviors. Sometimes we have to look at indicators of those behaviors. So what are some of those indicators or pieces? Stephanie talks about actual instances of bystander intervention, to have people be able to talk about when they actually have done something. That's been a really useful piece. The ability to convey empathy, actively asking for consent, witnessing domestic violence, which we know there's great associations with this. Decrease in sexist and victim-blaming language. I love listening to some people's surveys where they actually send people a whole wave of middle tools, and they would go there with little clickers and count how many instances of sexist comments were made, and homophobic comments to be able to measure the what's going on in the environment, disclosures of violence and abuse, crime rates, which then we can get to, you know, other indicators that can relate to this, defending others from domestic violence, positive mentoring or positive peer influence. Now, Paul, you created another category that you had, which was, I found interesting, that was novel ideas. What do you mean by that?
Well, some people have really done some kind of out-of-the-box thinking. Like in one, for one evaluation, they phoned up participants after a rape prevention program on a college campus and asked people if they were willing to volunteer at a anti-violence activity. And so that way, you know, they were able to see that, you know, their hypothesis was that after participating in a sexual assault prevention program, that participants would be more likely to, you know, to volunteer to help out a women's organization or whatever. So that kind of intrigued me as a really unique kind of thinking.
Ray, why is that? I think really segues well into, thank you, Paul, into some of the work that Maida can talk about. And I have to say I have a bias on this because I, in addition to Prevention Connection, also directed California's My Strength campaign for the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. This is a campaign that takes Men Can Stop Rape programs and adapted it for California and came up with a social marketing campaign that integrated not just the media pieces, as you see the poster there, but also developing what in California, Men of Strength clubs throughout the country, and in California, My Strength Club. You see a picture of one of the clubs from a small rural community, to be able to have trained those young men to become leaders in their community. And that, so, Maida, can you talk about the work that the California Department of Public Health was doing to be able to evaluate this program and what you were trying to look at?
Yeah, thanks, David. We attempted to answer just the overall question, how do you measure social norms change? And as we mentioned earlier, it's a difficult question. And just to put it out there, too, this is one example of how we attempted to answer the question. And I hope we can maybe get into a dialogue about other ways and other sorts of indicators that other people might have used in the past or good ideas in the future. But for this evaluation, this is an evaluation of a social marketing campaign, and this was implemented in high schools around California. We wanted to measure the social climate within the overall school. So, you know, not just to measure the individual change in the club members of the My Strength clubs, but to see what how that message spread around the school and how that changed the overall social climate. So we had a survey and included some of the things that Paul mentioned, knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs, bystander behavior, and also how the students heard about the My Students campaign. So by doing that, we attempted to measure the message delivery and like how they heard about the campaign and tie that into the change in the overall school climate. Some of the threads within the whole campaign was to look at, you know, the resiliency of the students. I know David mentioned that previously in looking at how those act as protective factors for the students in preventing perpetration. So mainly the campaign was directed at boys high school age, and in our evaluation we actually found just after 1 year of our evaluation that we did see some small changes, and obviously, you know, that being in five or six schools in the initial pilot program, we didn't get a lot of data for our first year, but we are continuing an evaluation and hope to have more results in the future. we did find that the students exposed to the campaign had more respectful attitudes overall, and they disapproved of a lot of the negative attitudes that they saw on campus, and this was also associated with actual instances that were reported on the surveys of the behavior where they would intervene if they saw something going on that they didn't approve of. So just to kind of recap this evaluation that we attempted to embark upon, we wanted to do this to help build the evidence base, because as David mentioned previously, it's important to build evidence base for them. And this is something that when we looked at California in doing a needs assessment, this is something that a lot of people are watching and wanting to look at, because everyone's been told, you know, they need to look at evidence-based practices and promising practices. And the only way we can do that is to continue the evaluation of these programs and to put more efforts towards continuing our evaluation. And by doing this, we can get more reliable data on these programs and find out what works, basically.
Part of, I think, an important piece of this is that we do need to be able to link that the intervention, the activity we did was a community-based activity, trying to develop, doing community-wide work, being the school community, and that it was not done just trying to change individuals. And that you have to make sure to do a community-based work, you have to look at the broader community, not just the individual, trying to just change knowledge or individual behavior. So a lot of these were community-oriented activities and big school-wide events and having these young people really be ambassadors around this topic and take leadership. That was, I think, what allowed this to happen.
I'd like to add here that this really takes a tremendous amount of upfront work in terms of organization and getting buy-in from these different schools. Sometimes it just seems like, we read these articles and they're good or they're not good. But to get a school district to let you come in and do this doesn't happen because you make one phone call.
And in fact, in California, it was built on years and years of work. And I was surprised to see for back to school night, they let rape prevention be the major theme of that. That took a lot of foundation that was built in relationships, and it helped that it was actually a small community where people knew the people that were doing the campaign, but it does take a lot of work to move forward. Well, I want to segue into, because this conversation just is going much faster than we were hoping it to go to Pat to be able to talk about some of the work that you've been doing. So, Pat, can you talk about some of the work over in Texas that you've been engaged with?
Sure. We have a violence prevention campaign that uses methods of community-based participatory action research. That is, the acronym for that is CBPR. And just for folks who are not familiar with that, CBPR means that the relationship between the researcher and the community is very, very much shifted, and we sit as equals around the table. So we do not come to the community and tell them what we're going to do. We come to the community and ask them what it is that they want help with, or what could they use, what topic is of importance to them. And this community in San Antonio told us that it was violence that they were interested in. So we started looking at different kinds of violence interventions that we could present to them, and there's a community council that tells us yes or no, this will work, this will not work. What we are using for measurement in the intervention itself is a 10-session program, but there are many, many community activities to support the intervention content. So we really wanted to radiate out from the individual kids to their families to the communities. And our goal was to look at measures in different schools, but also to improve the overall community's social capital. And social capital is a new but already controversial idea. It's an ecological characteristic that talks about the amount of connectedness and the quality and quantity of social relationships. And there's some nice evidence out there that looks at different health disparities and their relationship to social capital. And violent events is one of those disparities.
And I have seen a little bit of nothing published, but I know that some researchers are looking at questions of social capital with dating violence. And some of the preliminary indications is that, once again, there is an association there.
And when somebody talked earlier about using some measures of environment, I mean, we could do this on a community level. We could look at the social capital and the amount of connectedness in a school, say, and look at dating violence vis-a-vis that. There are three measures on the next slide, three pretty standard measures, collective efficacy, neighborhood conditions, and neighborhood integration. There are many others, but these could be nicely adapted to other non-community or non-neighborhood environments. I'm thinking of schools. So we're hoping that social capital is going to give us some better results than our pretest. Our pretest started so high, everyone was so high, that it just we've gotten nothing out of looking at out of the differences or any change in those measures. And do other people have people?
Oh, I'm sorry. Someone asked a question about is the relationship to empowerment-based evaluation. Is that are these just different words or different types of evaluation?
Well, empowerment evaluation is more at the end. And this in CDTR, you're actually using the method from the very beginning. And I think empowerment evaluation might be more after you decide on what you're doing. And also the community decides, do they like these measures or not? So I think it's similar but not identical. Are there any people who are using, in the audience who are using CBPR in any violence prevention activities?
If anyone is using it, could you either write in a text chat or raise your hand and we can call on what you're doing? I do not. I see Rose Wild says she's kind of. And several people are going to be, many people will probably talk about how they're using the CDC's Getting to Outcomes, which is an empowerment evaluation, but it's not the same as the community participatory. So several people are saying that it sounds like the empowerment evaluation in these. Well, we are getting to a stage where I want to open this up for if there's anyone that has any questions or comments. We don't have nearly enough time, but I want to be able to add that. So if you have a question or comment, this is the time you can either raise your hand and we can call on you, or we can be able to, although I think you can't raise your hand because the floor holder thing has disappeared. So if you want to ask a question, go into the text chat and say, I have a question, and then we will pick your name. So that's one of our pieces. And, there's Stephen's laptop as he is getting ready to show the picture again.
David, there's a good question here from Jen Margulies. Could you get started to Pat? Pat, do you see it?
Yes, I do. The community members have elected what we're calling a Community Coordinating Council, the CCC, and they meet monthly, and we go over where we are as university representatives, what our needs are, what their needs are, how do these fit together, what give and take can we do here, and also they're very influential in setting up the other community activities that support the intervention itself. We also did some data work with them. It was a little overwhelming, but they got it. We did. We trained about 30 people from the community getting IRB certificates because they were the people who did the data collection for us. And getting 30 community people trained to have IRB certification was interesting. So we like to feel that we're leaving them with more than when we started. And actually, the school district is going to pick up the program, so we're very good about that.
Okay, well, a question from Lisa Fujia-Parks. Can you speak to the challenges within tight-knit communities where oppressive hierarchical relationships are maintained through sexism, racism, and homophobia, which contribute to the climate that condones sexual violence? So how do we work in there?
I actually have something to say about that, too. This is Pat again. I think that in every community, even a tight-knit community that has such a structure, I bet you could find enough women to do a kind of promotora or community health worker program. And those women would tell you how to proceed, as opposed to us coming in and telling them that this is what they should be doing. I think that we take our guidance from the community.
You take describe what an IRB training is?
It was Institutional Review Board, and it's permission to conduct research, and sometimes it's really just an enormous pain in the neck. It's supposed to be protecting the rights of research participants, but you know, we're doing prevention work. We're not using phase one drug trials, but the amount of scrutiny that our work gets, you would think that we were really doing something very highly technical.
Okay. Can you give a specific example of a social capital interventionist strategy?
Sure, increasing connectedness between people in a community. So community night out or showing movies on the side of the school, having family sports events.
I mean, one that we piloted on Prevention Connection in the past was an example of a group like Girl Fest that would create poetry slams around issues of violence against women's prevention, which would then build linkages of communities and be able to use that as a way to bring a community together, and then you can focus on these. You may not always be around the topic, but then the topic can be addressed. Well, is there any last comments that I want to get from any of our panelists? Because we are running out of time. We have a lot of great questions, and we are going to post the comments, and if there's any questions in here, all of our presenters have agreed that we'll look at these questions, and then we'll answer them onto the website and point you to some resources. So, and then there's some of you who are giving resources in here, so this will be able to direct each other to those resources and move forward. So any last comments? Maya, do you have any last comments?
I just want to say it's great that we're having this discussion. I wish we had more time just to sort of maybe discuss some more, you know, like risk reduction measurements and things like that. But I think we'll kind of read through the questions. I'm kind of trying to follow along with the questions, and there's so many. But, you know, we'll read through these and figure out what we can answer for you guys.
Okay. Paul? Paul, might have put mute on his phone on mute.
Yes, thank you very much.
Any last comments?
I think the conversation was great. I love the list of ideas for outcomes to measure that came from the participants. I think we should all kind of look at those in the future as we work to evaluate our prevention programs and to really think outside the box. Another thing is to think strategically. you know, sometimes it's so difficult to get into schools. It'd be really nice if we could find some outcomes. And I've had this experience in at least one middle school where I've gone in and trying to help a program get into a school. Principal says, oh, you know, our babies aren't dating, our babies aren't doing this. And then the incident, the kid waiting out in the hallway to talk to the principal is there because he held a girl against the lockers and was kissing her against her will. So there's a lot of education that's going on. If we can link, you know, improve relationship skills, improve social emotional skills, which is many of the outcomes that people indicated, to improve grades and improve attention, you know, improve classroom management, then these schools are going to be more and more eager to have us come in to work with their students. So I hope to keep that, those practical things in mind as you consider different outcomes to measure.
Okay, and there's several great comments that I see. Some of them are close to home, and we did interview them. Amy Thompson from Close to Home at a web conference you can find on in our archives. And some of them are talking about Debbie Fry has been doing some really exciting work with the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault, really looking at story action research in doing that. Or you do see your evaluation form on here. We are getting to that 1 minute left. Please, we did have a little bit of technical challenges, but I was really pleased with our discussion and that we were able to have today. We will be posting all of this information, and this is a conversation that we will be looking at how we can continue this. I would encourage you, as we do our reading club presentations, to join those and get into smaller conversations with other Prevention Connection users to think about how we're going to do the work, and that we will be having some of these coming up soon. And it's a really great opportunity to meet people online and be able to share ideas as we can move forward in looking at how we are going to advance the primary prevention of violence against women. So I am out of time. I'm sorry, Sarah, I didn't get a chance to get to you for the last comment, but I want to really thank all of our presenters, Mina, Pat, Paul, and Sarah, for their work. You will see links to their work and organizations on the website. We'll be adding more information as is requested, and we will be having more web conferences. So please sign your evaluation. You can sign up for our TURF conference. When you complete the evaluation, it will take you to the Prevent Connect website. Registration should be open now. And what I'm going to do is, if the speakers can stay on the phone, and you will be put into a little conference so we can talk about this afterwards. And all the rest of you, I want to thank you for today's contribution. And if you have ideas of how we can advance this conversation, put it in the evaluation, and we will, that's how we develop a lot of our programs here at Prevention Connection. So thank you all, and have a wonderful rest of your day as we are all reaching the conclusion of Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So thank you very much, and this will conclude the audio portion of the presentation. Can all of the presenters stay on the phone, and you can all fill out the evaluation form now. Thank you. I'm going to give it back to Kyle.
Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for attending. This concludes the conference. You may now disconnect.